Hello!
Hello!
I'm Max Davey.
And I'm Tess Davey.
And this is the ADHD Science Podcast.
Sure is.
Why do we do an ADHD Science Podcast, Tess?
Because we're spreading the word, and it's fun, and it's interesting.
Okay, and also we're ADHD people.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a paediatrician, and you are kind of a psychology student.
Oh, God. That's pressure. Well, I will be soon.
Right. Just in case people are wondering who these random people are.
Mm-hmm.
We have... Well, we're coming towards the end of the season. Series.
Series. Series.
Which I really liked.
Wow, I'm a genius.
Yeah. And we've got one more episode after today.
Mm-hmm.
We have had some feedback. People wanting... content on sleep, and by coincidence,
well,
today's not about sleep, but next week.
Well, I'll know from the title.
Today is Dennis Golm, from Southampton, and he's going to talk about early emotional negativity and ADHD. So That sounds a little dry, but it's really about whether there's a link between that very early temperament of babies and children and them later having ADHD. And it got us on to talking about emotions and ADHD, which regular listeners will know is a topic we talk about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And is a bit neglected by, well, most people, really.
Yes.
So, anything else to say?
Not particularly.
Okay, let's get on with the episode.
Woo!
Hey. Well, welcome. Welcome, Dennis. Dennis Golm from the University of Southampton. Could you introduce yourself and then we'll get on with talking about your research?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Dennis. I'm a lecturer in psychology at the University of Southampton. We have research centres. I work in the Centre for Innovation Mental Health, and I conduct research and teach on the topic of early adversity, childhood maltreatment, and kind of my research tries to understand the mechanisms via which early adverse experiences lead to mental health problems, and also interactions with new developmental diagnoses.
Just before we get started, I know I love definitions. You don't love definitions, Tess. I love...
I'm neutral on definitions. They're a part of life, and I accept that.
I think they're very important. And so I think it's worth... I mean, obviously, we don't necessarily need to define ADHD for our audience because we've done a lot of that and people should know. But it's worth just thinking what we mean when we say maltreatment and when we say early childhood adversity. Could you just sort of expand on those a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean... So early adversity is more of an umbrella term that would, maltreatment would be part of early adversity, but early adversity is all kinds of negative stress experiences early in life. And childhood maltreatment, there's like an official definition, but generally it includes all forms of neglect and all forms of abuse. And under abuse, we would kind of sum up physical abuse, so hitting a child, emotional abuse, so calling children dumb, lazy, or yelling at them to the extent that they feel fear, and then sexual abuse.
Yeah. So those are the terms. And so should we do our first question so we can sort of start off where you started with this bit of research?
So what question were you answering with your research?
So... we were interested, there's this, so I do also research on kind of people who have been adopted or are in foster care. And we have this overlap of people with new developmental diagnoses like ADHD and autism in children in care, but also amongst kind of maltreated population. Those two overlap, unfortunately, quite a lot. And I was interested in the question why that is, and some colleagues of mine have written this beautiful paper of a large twin studies of 8,000 twins in Sweden, where they looked at the association between different new developmental diagnoses, ADHD amongst them, and maltreatment in mono and dizygotic twins. And what they found was that there is a much, much higher prevalence of ADHD in twins who have been maltreated, but that is largely explained by genetic factors. So, and there's a small effect on kind of symptoms of ADHD. And that got us curious. And we thought, okay, and also the paper hypothesized that there might be kind of earlier, maybe temperamental traits that explain why children with ADHD are more prone to maltreatment, like before they develop ADHD. So we thought, or maybe it's like, because there's this paper showing that different temperament dimensions kind of predict ADHD onset during childhood. And one of them is negative emotionality. And we thought, or maybe kind of these early temperament dimensions are a risk factor for not only for ADHD, but also for kind of maltreatment.
So I'm going to stop you there, because there's a lot to unpack in that little summary that you...
Sorry.
So the first thing is the twin studies, because you talked about monozygotic and dizygotic twins, and you probably have come across this a bit.
I think you expect me to know more about
that. No, that's fine, because you're not here to know things. But can we just talk about what twin studies are and why those two words are important in trying to...
Yeah, sure.
So, trying to tease that out, because I think it's the twin studies debut in the podcast.
So that twin study was conducted by children by colleagues at the University of Edinburgh, led by Lisa Dinkler. So monozygotic twins are twins that share 100% of their genetic material, and dizygotic twins are basically siblings born at the same time that share 50% of their genetic material.
And the lay kind of language of that would be identical and non-identical, although I appreciate that's technically, you have to be a bit technical about that.
And kind of looking at twins who did and did not experience maltreatment allows you to look at the effects of maltreatment, but also controlling for shared genetic effect. So, because it might be that it's not the effect of maltreatment, but it's more like because they both have a genetic risk for developing ADHD. So kind of twin research designs allow people to understand what is driven by genetics and what is driven by environment.
You look at pairs of twins, and the really interesting ones is where one's been maltreated and one hasn't.
Yes. Or
because, do you see what I mean? Because then you've got almost like a grid. You've got like maltreated and monozygotic, not maltreated and monozygotic. So you look at the difference between those two populations, and then you've got the non-identical or dizygotic twins and the two differences between the maltreated and non-maltreated there, and you look at how different they all are.
I mean, essentially it's removing the variable of biology so that you can just look at the effect that the environment has on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the theory.
Yeah.
It's not...
I understand in practice it's...
Yeah, it's a bit more complicated. But yeah. I think that's a pretty good...
Yeah.
That's a pretty good way of putting it.
So that study gave us the idea, and they hypothesized, oh, maybe there's some kind of shared or traits, temperamental traits, maybe that share a risk with ADHD. And that's why I thought, okay, that's interesting. And then another colleague in London, they performed this meta-analysis. A meta-analysis is where you look at studies that have already been published and kind of summarize across, run some analysis across and see what is there an effect across all of these studies. And they looked at different temperamental traits and wanted to know whether they predict different new developmental diagnoses. And one of them was negative emotionality, and they found that predicted ADHD onset. So what got us interested in negative emotionality. So that's when kind of a baby cries a lot, fusses a lot, kind of overreacts to things, so gets upset easily. So that kind of behavior.
So I'm interested in what you mean by temperament. Again, it's definitions boy flying in to say today.
We need him. I mean, this is supposed to be my job, but I'm not very good at it.
But what do you mean temperament? Because are children born with temperament? Is that a fixed part of their biology? What does temperament? What is temperament? And what does it? What does it? What does it mean?
I mean, I don't know what the textbook Danish definition is, but I would define it as something almost like a personality trait that is present early on in development, so that you can already observe in kind of infants or babies that are, yeah, you know, a couple of months old to a year,
yeah,
certain personality dimensions, like how curious are they, right? How active are they? How easy do they cry? How easy are they upset? Are they quite, you know, happy with lots of change, or have they problem adapting to lots of change, for instance? So it's kind of dimensions of how they act, and but also of how they control the emotions. A big word, because babies can't really do that, but you know, but it's more like how emotional are they, how active are they, these kind of things,
and how, and when they get a bit older, how easy are they to make laugh and smile and those sorts of things. And so
exactly,
and those attempt, those, I mean, obviously they show themselves in different ways, but the significance is that temperamental traits in really small babies are important for how the person ends up, the personality ends up later in life, with obviously lots of, you know, twists and turns in between, lots of water under the bridge. But it's important how you are as a baby and how you are as an adult connect in some way.
Yeah. So it's kind of, so in that case where it predicts ADHD, I think it was two or three temperament dimensions that predicted ADHD. But it's small effects, so right. But so it's small pieces of the puzzle. But it's interesting because it might be that is because they share similar genes. So it might be that, you know, the same, so that they are maybe represent kind of early risk factors or early signs of ADHD, maybe, or it might just, you know, or they share some of the genes that lead to ADHD, for instance. But also, it could also be not genetic, but it's also how, so the interaction between parents and how a child behaves, right? So a baby might behave in a certain way, and then the parent reacts to that behavior in either a positive or negative way. And because of how the parents react to that behavior, the baby will react in a certain way. So it's very hard to disentangle these things.
But disentangling, so quite hard to disentangle that word. To disentangling these things was what you were aiming to do with your study, I believe. Well, I mean, you know, to an extent. So exactly what did you do? And I'm going to jump in with a question too. And what did you find when you did the thing? I'm doing all your jobs. You need to be jumping in doing your jobs.
I'm sorry, I'm tired.
It is quite late, to be fair. So we took an pre-existing data set from the University of Princeton, which is called the Fragile Families and Wellbeing Study. It's a large data set where, for some reason, they oversampled unmarried women. I think they wanted to look at the some socioeconomic effects, I think that was the idea, but they have lots of data available from kind of infancy up until, I think, age 11 or even 15. And they had measures on ADHD symptoms. They had measures on negative emotionality in infants. And they had measures on kind of childhood maltreatment. So everything we needed for our study. And we wanted to see, so the question was, so we kind of know that negative emotionality predicts ADHD, and we wanted to see, and we know that childhood maltreatment predicts ADHD symptoms, so not ADHD onset as a disorder, but symptoms. We wanted to know, so does negative emotionality not only predict ADHD symptoms, but also childhood maltreatment? That was one question. And the other question was, we know that childhood maltreatment predicts ADHD symptoms, but do ADHD symptoms also predict later maltreatment? So is ADHD itself a risk factor for being maltreated by a caregiver?
Okay, good.
And importantly, we're talking symptoms here, not disorder. So we're not talking about... Yeah.
So you said something that was really interesting, because you said, now let me get this right, that maltreatment was associated with ADHD symptoms, but not with ADHD onset. Can yes. you explain that? Because I think that might end up being important later on.
Yes, so that's what they found in the twin study, is that they found that whether or not people have a diagnosis of ADHD, that is largely explained by genetics. But there's a small effect on the symptom load, so how many ADHD symptoms or how severe yeah. ADHD symptoms someone has. And that has also been replicated in adults, that there is this effect of maltreatment on ADHD symptoms.
Yeah.
But not necessarily onset.
So it sort of doesn't change your chances of getting ADHD. And I think this is really important. It doesn't necessarily change the chance of getting ADHD, but it may make the ADHD you have more difficult to manage.
More yes. easy to diagnose.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. Because it's, there's a question mark whether maybe in very, very severe cases of maltreatment, whether it could override genetic risk. But then I'm talking about some of our studies of kind of adoptees who experienced very severe early institutional deprivation. And in that case, we might argue it could potentially override genetic risk. But there's obviously a question mark. But generally, I would say the effect seems to be more pronounced on symptoms.
And when you, this is not necessarily a cheerful episode in lots of ways. Maybe we should put some warnings at the top. But when you say institutional abuse, it's sort of not necessarily the Romanian orphan cohort specifically, but people who have been abandoned very early on and receive very poor care within institutions, often not in the UK. Because whatever else we get wrong, we don't necessarily do that.
No, there are hardly any institutions left in the UK, if any, that's residential care. But in that case, I was referring to Romanian orphans because I've been involved in the English Romanian adoptee study.
Right.
But generally, institutional care is bad. It's not good generally. There's a drive towards deinstitutionalization based on lots of data that it's definitely worse
so foster,
than
foster kind of, families rather than
family-based care is better, much better than kind of institutionalized care. So even if institutions are quite good, there's still negative effects. So even if, you know, they're clean and there's food, there's still quite often a low kind of child to staff ratio, so that there's not enough staff or high turnover.
Yes,
so this exactly. kind of yeah so
it's just the lack of stability or one significant care figure that you yeah. can rely on and yeah. form a significant attachment to.
Well, I mean,
this is all, as far as I'm aware from the learning I've done.
No, I mean, we're not necessarily going to be going deep into attachment.
Yeah,
attachment is the key mechanism here, isn't it? Probably
definitely one of them.
Yeah. But to go back to your, it's fine. We're going off on tangents is what we do. But to go back to your study, so you're looking at this cohort of single parents, single mothers.
They're just oversampled for single mums, but most of the data comes from mums and not so much from dads.
So you just explain the word oversample that you used.
It's the study. So the people who collected the longitudinal data, they recruited more single mums than married mums, because the idea for the study, I think, originally was to look at the effects of single motherhood on child development, I believe, or child well-being, and that's how the study came into play. So it's more like a sample that is skewed towards a lower socioeconomic status.
Longitudinal research is research that takes place over a long time.
Thank you, Tess.
I'm trying to contribute something.
You are contributing a lot. Questions, observations.
Yeah.
Hair. Your hair looks really nice.
Oh, thanks.
There you go.
think it's the lighting.
It is the lighting. The lighting on your hair is excellent. I was just trying to think of what you're.
I mean, the beard hair on the other side of the screen is also.
There's some
incredible strong
beard hair, yeah. So if you're not watching, if you're not on YouTube, if you're on audio, just at least check out the YouTube.
Yeah.
Because this we go on video and audio at ADHD UK. We're.
You can see our lovely faces.
You can see our lovely faces.
Sorry, enough about us.
Okay, so. We keep trying to get back to your studies and what you actually did. We were not getting very well. So we got this cohort and you examined data that was already out there in the world, yes. And looked for correlations and looked for how you reading the paper, you sort of almost built a model of yes. how you thought the world might work and see how well that model matches the data. And that's important. I think that's important for people to get their heads around.
Yeah, that's exactly what we did. We tested a kind of statistical longitudinal statistical model, which is usually something where you have something like a predictor or some symptoms that predict a behavior later in a couple of years later down the line. And we also tested some what we would call mediators. So, mediators, kind of a mechanism that might explain an association between two things. So it might be that, so it could be that negative emotionality predicts ADHD symptoms, but that is because it increases maltreatment, and maltreatment then in turn increases ADHD symptoms, for instance. So that's what a mediator is, and we looked at a couple of those as well.
There's a lovely little cycle going on there, isn't there?
Yeah, lovely is one word for it. So what?
Being sarcastic.
Just for the benefit of our listeners who've become confused by us constantly getting distracted, what was the model that you found? What is your best guess at how these things interrelate? According to your model,
so we found that kind of negative emotionality of an infant at 12 months of age predicts ADHD symptoms directly or indirectly 4 and 8 years further down the line, and also, and that was the thing we were interested in, negative emotionality also predicted maltreatment through the caregiver at ages 5 and 9 years. If kind of parents report my child cries more, kind of overreacts to things, it's very fussy, then they had a higher likelihood of reporting to maltreat their child to a higher degree kind of at age 5 and age 9 years. That was one of the main findings.
Okay. So, I mean, I think it's probably worth moving on to our third question, because the implications of that are very interesting.
What does this mean for people looking after ADHD people? So that can be teachers, parents, doctors.
Mm.
Yeah. I think, first of all, it's important to say that the effects we found, while they were there and significant, they were small in nature, right? They are not what we would call deterministic, in the sense that they increase the likelihood of being maltreated. So it's a risk factor for a baby to be maltreated later. But it doesn't mean that only because it's present in the baby, so the baby cries a lot, that they will be maltreated, if that makes sense, right? It's just something that increases the probability.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a small effect. So it's one piece of the puzzle, but one piece that might kind of help us explain why we have this overlap between ADHD symptoms and maltreatment. So why we have, much higher proportions of children with ADHD in samples that have been maltreated, like children who live in care, for instance, right, where two-thirds live in care because they have been maltreated. And we have much higher numbers of ADHD than in the general population. So it's kind of trying to explain where that overlap might come from. And maybe it's because, there are early indicators that put them at risk, like, for example, negative emotionality. But also the other thing is that having ADHD symptoms themselves put them is a risk factor that increases maltreatment later on. So it's not one directional, but it goes in kind of both directions.
Yes, so exactly. because a child who's exhibiting a child who's negatively emotional, you know, early in life, and then starts developing, gets sort of a bit neglected, starts developing ADHD symptoms, but also presumably other symptoms such as oppositional defiance and aggression.
Define opposition.
I will in a minute. Okay. They are more likely, therefore, to the placement with their birth parents to break down.
Yeah.
And of course, there's obviously parental things, often parents with ADHD themselves who, you know, with their own issues. So I think that's the story here. Oppositional defiance is basically, the way I kind of explain it, and please come in, but basically it's like the child can't meet the needs of the adult world and basically just goes, no, I'm not doing it. Just stop.
Okay.
And often it kind of manifests itself in refusal to follow instructions, tantrums, but not, it's distinct from something that comes up later in older childhood, which is deliberate. It's not necessarily deliberately going out of your way to hurt or disrupt the adult world. It's just resisting the adult world,
yeah,
and doing whatever it takes to,
okay,
to not do as you're told.
That makes sense.
Whereas conduct problems and conduct disorder is much more sticking two fingers up at the adult world and trying to kind of undermine it, being a bit more delinquent.
Peace.
What do you mean, peace?
Two fingers.
Oh, fine, yeah. Two fingers the other way. Or even one finger. Or even one finger, no! Tess.
No! Yeah, okay, that does make sense.
Does that make
sense?
Yeah, okay. Is that okay? Yeah.
Yes.
That sort of reasonable.
Good job, definition room.
Thanks, definition boy. That's a reasonable kind of summary, Dennis.
Yeah, I mean, what I think one important kind of limitation of this study is that we don't know whether or not parents or caregivers in that case had ADHD. We don't know because we didn't have data on that.
Yeah.
And then we mentioned that that's, you know, a limitation that we couldn't control for, you know, parental levels of because there's a high genetic link, you know, it might very well be that caregivers also have higher levels of ADHD symptoms.
And we do know that there's a genetic link.
Oh, yeah,
100%. So there are certain assumptions you can make, although obviously you can't make a general sweeping statement about it, but you can go that,
yeah,
you can say probably a lot of these children's parents did have ADHD. But then again, if you're looking at environmental factors, that might not be the case. And if you're talking about how it may override genetic risks.
Yeah, but I think that's only with quite extreme.
Yeah.
I mean,
there are certain assumptions you can make in that case.
I mean, I sometimes slightly wish that we hadn't kind of studied the Romanian orphans quite as intensively as we did, because they sort of give the impression that things can happen. There's a very extreme case, and people extrapolate that to, I'm not trying to minimize somebody who grows up poor, is, you know, has a parents who have their own issues with mental health and drugs, and, you know, gets neglected, ends up in care. That's really difficult, but it's really different to, you know, the kind of scenes that we had in the sort of early 90s of these children who had no care virtually at all.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we always say it's a very severe form of neglect, so that's what it's kind of comparable with somewhat, but there are also other things, because it was obviously very, very hygiene was very bad, and then also obviously
physical condition was also very poor.
Yeah.
Is this the Romanian orphanage where I don't want to go into detail, but it was just they were all really packed in, and there was no solid figures, and they weren't fed much, and people who don't know what it is, it's just a pretty horrible treatment of a lot of orphans in Romania.
Yeah, and a lot of them are not orphans. It's institutions.
Yes. No,
they are called orphanages, but technically,
it is an orphanage because I think there was something to do with the overpopulation and no one could take care of their kids, so they were giving them into the government because the government were like, "We'll take care of your kids," and then the government did not take care of the kids.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's a whole ordeal.
Not to dwell on them, which is not
that's a pretty good summary, though.
Yeah, sorry, because, I just wanted to make sure
because the kids that we're usually dealing with day to day have not starved. Have not, just as mean, have materially done.
The majority of children who end up in care end up in care because of neglect.
Yeah.
So that is But neglect can mean anything, right? Neglect can also be supervision neglect. So kind of mom and dad might be too drunk or too high to take care of their children, or they might not supervise them and they play where it's dangerous for them or where they could get hurt very seriously. Or it might be that they don't wear proper clothes for the weather or are emotionally neglected. So it's, you know, lots of different types of neglect.
It's really variable, actually, isn't it?
It's not a delightful topic, is it? But
I think in a way, sort of neglect is really important to talk about, because what it is, I think, is a failure to meet the child's needs in whatever way.
Yes.
And I use the word failure. I don't know if it's even the right word, because sometimes it almost gives the idea of it being deliberate.
No, I teach a third-year undergrad module, which is called Childhood Maltreatment and Mental Health. So we only talk about the topic and links to mental health. And as part of the module, we invite some guests. For instance, we invite social workers from a regional adoption agency. And we were talking about that, whether they think that it's maltreatment is deliberate, and they were like, probably in my career, the vast majority of cases is not deliberate. It's not like the caregivers are intentionally hurting the children, but it's more like it's not black and white. It's a very complex situation. Often they experience trauma themselves or maltreatment themselves. Yeah. So it's
But just to go back to the implications of your data for clinicians or for teachers, what I suppose the first thing is, one of the things that happens is that we get presented with these kids and they have been maltreated, or they are looked after by the local authority or whatever, and they're exhibiting ADHD symptoms. And there's often a bit of a kind of debate about, well, is this properly ADHD, or is it a consequence of their maltreatment? And to me, the implication of what you've said is that, yes, the ADHD symptoms may have been made a bit worse by the maltreatment, but we can't put the whole thing down to the maltreatment.
Yeah, exactly. I would say, so they definitely can make ADHD worse. And I think that is true, I think, for lots of let's call them challenging behaviors, maybe of children who experienced maltreatment. Because I would say it's important to not take these kind of behaviors personally or interpret something into them, right? So it's more like understanding where they come from, rather than kind of punishing the child for behavior that they cannot do much about, maybe. So it's more like helping them to maybe develop strategies to control their behavior, so that they can maybe pay better attention, or that they don't accidentally hurt someone or so. But it's more like understanding where it's coming from, and then meeting them in an empathetic way, and helping. Because there's a good example would be, that's one from the UK Trauma Council. It's like there's a swim team. That someone gives the other person like a friendly shove, and they kind of completely overreact because they think that was intentional to hurt them and kind of dunk them underwater. And then the swim coach could react in a kind of punitive way and kind of say, oh, you're excluded from the swim team now. Or they could understand where that overreaction comes from and work with the child on understanding why they react that way and help them to not react that way in the future and give them a chance to change it, right? Which would be more like a trauma-informed way of dealing with
behavior. So in a way, if you're thinking about, so from a doctor's point of view, we're sort of deciding about diagnosis. From a teacher's point of view, often they are trying to balance discipline against understanding. And I suppose one of the implications is that, yes, maltreatment may be important as well, but the ADHD needs to be treated as the ADHD, and the maltreatment, but the whole thing needs just to be understood as behaviours that come from somewhere, are not necessarily deliberate, but arise from this kind of complex web of different kind of causative factors.
No pressure to the teacher.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I'm like, you've got 30 kids. How are you going to do that?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of understanding that, you know, a child with ADHD is not, don't know, it you know, sometimes they are annoying in the classroom because they are loud or can't sit still or, you know.
I mean, and we have both been that child.
Right?
You still, well, less so now.
But it's not like they are, but I guess it's just understanding that they're not intentionally being annoying, right? It's more like they can't help themselves and don't know how to deal with all the, you know, stimulation or there's not enough stimulation, right? So, you know,
yes, exactly, either over or under stimulation and
so they might be much better listening if they kind of are moving around on the chair or have a fidget spinner in their hand,
yeah,
because that might help, you know, concentrate. I think it's just yeah, think about that. They're not doing that to wind you up.
Although sometimes,
well, you know, of course, everyone, right?
I mean, I think it's so much more difficult than the job of a doctor to decide whether someone's got ADHD or not. Is the job of a teacher to engage these often really, you know, people with lots of complex behaviours in learning, and they do it with much less resources and
much less pay.
And much less pay.
Yeah, we work a lot with we do a lot of kind of science outreach with schools. So we spend a lot of, so I've been lucky enough to see you know, a few classrooms, and we did an after school club we ran an outreach project called NeuroKids, where we talk to little people about the brain.
Brilliant.
Basically, and bring brain models and little explainer videos and talk about different topics. From kind of reception up until year 9. So we were lucky enough to see a couple of classrooms, and yeah, I mean, you know, teachers doing quite a good job, but it's like a very hard job sometimes.
Yeah. Because you often get several kids with complex histories in a single class.
And sometimes they have support, like there's a teaching assistant who can help, or someone in the classroom, and they have one-to-one support, which is great. Sometimes,
but I suppose again, the maltreatment that they might know about, again, the sort of simple messages, the maltreatment that they might know about is important in influencing the symptoms, but it's not the reason the child has ADHD.
Yeah,
and so if they think a child has ADHD, they should refer for an assessment.
Yes, please.
exactly.
Also, it's important to say, not doing the other way around. So not because someone has symptoms of ADHD to think, oh, they have been maltreated, right? No, don't assume that, please. But, you know, because there are lots of different reasons why children have ADHD symptoms.
Yeah, no, that's very, very true. And that's why you, sort of, you need assessments, and that's why we need more resources for assessments. But that's another...
And we need them early. I think like for kind of children in risk groups, like particular children in foster care, I think if we had like a standard early diagnosis of mental health and new developmental symptoms, that would be fantastic to intervene early.
Well that's tricky, isn't it? And I think it almost kind of gets into the policy implications of your work.
Yeah.
Because clearly, if we can, you could even go back to the infancy, because you talk about diagnosis, and clearly you're not going to be diagnosing a hyperactive baby with negative.
Oh, no. ADHD. I mean, you wouldn't diagnose ADHD before age 3, probably.
I'm personally a bit ropey about doing it before 4.
Yeah.
But even then, so you could, in theory, come up with a story where you identify children with temperamental traits who are at risk of later maltreatment, and therefore pick them up, and not just the because there are projects of looking at high risk families, but we're talking about high risk babies.
Yeah, so I think that's where not health workers, the people who health visitors. Yeah, so that's, I guess, where they might come into play. So obviously I think it's very important to stress small effects, right? So not
determinist, sure.
But I think just monitoring and seeing, because I think one part might just be identifying parents who struggle with a child's temperament, right? And who might benefit from extra parental training or some strategies on how to deal with, or just from extra support, I think. Because, I mean, what we want to do, what's important to me is that, I would very much like to see that children don't experience maltreatment, because that's, such a risk factor for all sorts of things. And for obvious reasons, obviously, we don't want children to be maltreated. But I think it's kind of identifying maybe this child has a difficult temperament, and also can see the parent has trouble dealing with that. Because if your child is crying all the time, that is stressful. Of course, it's stressful. But if you then don't have the coping strategies or the parenting strategies, then it's much more likely that you kind of are overwhelmed and might overreact and, do something that's bad for you and the child. So I think it's about kind of identifying parents who might struggle with the temperament of their babies, and then offering early support to kind of prevent negative downstream consequences.
And I think it's sort of, that's not early diagnosis, that's early intervention.
No. Yeah, that's early intervention.
And I'm sort of a little wary of early diagnosis because it can get stuck. And if you don't make, if you've got people who are kind of in the ADHD ballpark but not quite there, and you don't make a diagnosis, everyone's like, oh, well, they said there wasn't. But it might be. We just don't know yet, if you go with the really little ones. And so I think we sort of need language which identifies high-risk situations without necessarily committing ourselves to the kind of diagnostic categories, which can become very hard to shift once you've kind of committed yourself.
Just remind me of what Alex is doing and stuff, but it can get to better.
Okay.
I just want to mention it. Start and Alex's stuff.
Go on. Tess has been working with some of the guys in Oxford about something similar to this. Go on.
Yeah. This reminds me of Alex Hendry's work and the intervention work that she does with high risk toddlers for ADHD and autism. And it's they use a lot of diagnostic tools with the babies to kind of, well, the toddlers, to kind of identify problems in executive functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And that, but they don't make a diagnosis. They're not there to make a diagnosis of the child. They're just there to identify the child's difficulties and help the parents create strategies.
So they're looking at these tools.
Understand how to help and support their child.
So they're looking at these tools more dimensionally.
I don't know what that means.
In terms of how much of these traits you've got, not whether between 0 and 10, how many of these traits have you got, rather than do you have a diagnosis, do you not have a diagnosis?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay.
See our Alex Hendry episode. Link in the show notes.
Okay, I should listen to that one. I think it's a big difference, right, between diagnosis implications of a diagnosis, right? Because a diagnosis should lead to treatment that helps in some way, right? While here it's more identifying mechanisms of risk to understand, why children with ADHD might be more at risk for being maltreated because of maybe early temperament and because of maybe their ADHD symptoms and how people react to them as well. Also things like, experiencing bullying then from outside of a caregiver context, right? Because other children can be mean as well.
Yes, other children can be very mean, like your brothers.
Okay.
Just trying to lighten the mood. Oh,
God.
They can be a bit mean.
They're your sons.
Okay, fine.
It's my job to make fun of them.
All right, let's do the last question. Let's move on. Before we start getting some sort of court case against me by my sons.
Realistically, it is only one of them. Okay. So what does this mean for ADHD people themselves?
I think from our study results, I would say because the negative, if you already have ADHD, then obviously your life as a baby might not be important. So in hindsight, it's more, I think, more relevance probably for children with ADHD that they might be at risk for male treatment because of their ADHD symptoms. So I think it might be relevant for, I mean, even though we didn't look at bullying in this study, but if we kind of assume, or we kind of also know that children with ADHD also have, experience from bullying. So it might be things like anti-bullying policies in school, or being aware who is at risk of getting bullied, but also maybe, you know, if there was some, would be some, when we diagnose a child with ADHD, maybe some mental health or neurodevelopmental diagnosis literacy for the parents, psychoeducation might be important to kind of, you know, how some parent training, maybe how to how to react to the behaviors the child is displaying, and what kind of parenting strategies, like punitive strategies, not to use.
We've got a generation of people who are becoming parents who know that they are ADHD. And so we have a lot of people who are worrying about how they then respond when a child is difficult, or whatever that means.
I mean, there's, I read this study, and I don't know what is interesting, but it might also be, and that there they had some preliminary evidence, or that the way they interpreted their evidence was maybe parents with ADHD can react better if their children have ADHD because they're familiar with the behaviours.
But then again, there can be extra issues there, because maybe, hypothetically, your ADHD manifests differently than that of your parent, and maybe your parent finds that slightly difficult to understand.
Yes,
maybe, Tess, that does sometimes happen. Do you think? Can you think of a pair of people whose ADHD is really quite different who sometimes misunderstand each other?
No, actually, I can't. So scrap everything I just said. I can't think of any examples.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to put out that, you know, it can be going in both directions. And understanding how it interacts would be quite interesting. But also keeping in mind that maybe the parents with ADHD have experienced more trauma or stressful experiences. And then is it the ADHD, or is it the stressful life experiences, right? So so it might not be the ADHD, it might be some trauma they have experienced because of their ADHD, or, you know, so it's very complex.
Yeah, and I think in a way, one of the things that I'm thinking about in terms of your work, and it isn't the kind of this is true, therefore I should do this kind, it's not that kind of implication, but I think what I've been struck by working with ADHD UK, the charity, and hearing the stories of people who are coming up to ADHD diagnosis or have just had an ADHD diagnosis as adults, is the number of traumatic experiences that they've had and how many have been, I would have said, maltreated, whether or not that was actually picked up. But you hear the stories, and the previous kind of manifestation of this podcast was Extraordinary Brains, and we basically heard lots of stories. You know, then half of them, I would say, people were maltreated by the definition that you've given. I mean, there were some really quite
it's common, right? It's not something that is super rare. Like when we look at studies where people answer, as adults answer questionnaire about growing up, then they would say that the most common type of maltreatment is emotional abuse. So kind of being yelled at, that you're afraid, or being called names, being called stupid, lazy, these kind of things.
Exactly.
That's almost experienced, if you talk kind of one-off incidents, but that's experienced by about a third of people.
And I suppose what I was getting at is that people might find it, one of the important things when you get to diagnosing yourself, you know, get to diagnosis, and when you become an adult and you have all these difficulties, is sense making. I think it's really powerful to kind of make sense of your experiences and what has happened to you. And I think this kind of narrative that, you know, this, you have these things about you which are unchangeable and temperamental and biological and genetic, whatever you want to call it, which have made you vulnerable to these other experiences, can be helpful in people's own narratives about themselves, I guess.
We had I had that exact situation. I was at a conference 2 weeks ago, and I presented this paper as a poster. So basically, poster is just a short scientific summary with lots of pictures, right? Where you talk to people for 1.5 hours or 2 hours who kind of are interested in your work. And I had one person come up and look at the poster and was like, "That's me. I've been diagnosed. I think they were they had been diagnosed with ADHD kind of recently, and were like looking at my post and think, yeah, a lot of what's on there kind of applies to me.
Yeah. And that can help. I mean, it can be difficult for people to sort of see it all laid out in that kind of unemotional language that you inevitably have to use when you're doing science. But also it can make people feel, oh, okay, what I've been through is something that's recognisable and can be made sense of, I suppose, sometimes.
Yeah, I think it helps understanding or retrospectively making sense of, you know, it wasn't me, or you know, this has happened because of. So I think, yeah, I do think that's a helpful thing. But I think what you said is quite important about, we have that generation of people with a diagnosis of ADHD who are becoming parents, and then, yeah, you know, providing them with awareness or tools that help would be great. But not saying they need them necessarily, right? But maybe some need them, and if they do, on the other way, kind of offering, you know, if we have health workers who has visitors, and then we have, you know, who spot families who struggle, children with difficult temperament, and just supporting them early on would be so nice, mm, if that would be possible.
It'd be so nice if we had resources to support vulnerable children early in life before they get into.
Well, I guess it's more about, let's say it's about priorities of, yeah, of people who make decisions about where money goes. I wonder who these people could be.
Space.
What should we do? The last one.
Yeah.
Good. Good.
So, what's your next question? What are you going to be working on once this is all wrapped up?
Actually, one follow-up project, and we just applied for some money, and we're hoping we're getting some money. We're going to hear this month, I believe, would be actually to study parents with ADHD and their children's temperament, and and also their history of maltreatment and other types of trauma, and to get some ideas of how this interacts. So is a combination of maybe the presence or absence of ADHD symptoms and the presence of absence of certain temperamental traits that are not a good combination, for instance, or could we say, hey, it's actually not, you know, or is it like parents' history of trauma and their interaction with the child's temperament that is important to know? So it's kind of, because in that study we didn't know whether parents had ADHD symptoms, so we didn't have any information on that. We want to do a study where we look at parents with a diagnosis of ADHD in that case, and who have kind of young children. We want to look at the temperament of the child. We want to look at the parent's history of trauma and their parenting behaviors, and see how it all interacts, in the hope to disentangle some of the questions we have. And then hopefully, if necessary, or get some ideas of, obviously we need to look at parents with and without ADHD, and then understand which parents might benefit from some support, and then the next step is to come up with that support.
Yes, well, exactly, and that's what it's all about. Well, brilliant. Thank you for that. We look forward to hearing the results of that when it gets published and I kind of see it in my Google Scholar feed. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Is there anything that you think we've missed out, that we haven't talked about, that you wanted to?
No, I think we covered everything. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I learned about ducks as well.
Yeah. Long boy.
Oh, I'm sorry about
Long
that.
Boy the duck is missing from York University.
I think we're missing. I think we should name our ducks on campus now.
Yeah, they should.
You should.
The Southampton duck should be named.
Yeah.
How about this time you find the shortest duck and you name it Short Boy instead? That would be good.
That would stick it to those Yorkists. Oh no, I'm back in the 15th century again. No. I'm thinking about the Wars of the Roses. You're not much of a history person, are you?
No,
never mind. All right, we'll stop there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. And bye.
Bye.
Okay, so that was the lovely Dennis from Southampton.
Lovely Dennis.
Dennis is the one contributor who's actually chased up whether the episode is to come out. So, hello, Dennis. I'm assuming you're going to listen. Dennis's episode was affected by some technical difficulties where I lost the login to the website for about 3 months.
Oh.
Yeah, so sorry about that. That was mainly my fault.
Sorry, Dennis.
But that's ADHD for you. You do dumb stuff.
So the login wasn't lost. You lost the login.
I lost the login.
Okay.
It's complicated. It's a boring story to do with.
You could have easily blamed that on technical difficulties. I respect you for owning up to it.
Well, I think we've got to show kind of, you know, who we are as people. Right, anyway, that on that bombshell, is it time to say goodbye?
I would like to have a nap, so we'll say it.
Okay, goodbye.
Nice to see you. Bye.